Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, we're talking about two new films, which, while journalism is not their central subject, directly engage news media's influence and impact as a critical part of the stories they tell. First up, you've heard the one about the woman who sued McDonald's for millions just because her coffee was hot. A new documentary tells the real story about that infamous case, starting with how almost everything you know about it is wrong, unless you're a longtime Counterspin listener, of course. The film Hot Coffee explores the real political fight over the past few decades, not about runaway juries and frivolous lawsuits, but much the opposite. Business interests spending millions to make sure you don't have your day in court. Peter Hart spoke with filmmaker Susan Saladoff about Hot Coffee. Also on the show, Battle for Brooklyn tracks the takeover of a New York neighborhood by a real estate developer and the efforts to resist it by community members, one man in particular who becomes the last person in his building not to take a buyout. The same events and players appeared in the corporate press, too, and viewers can see the difference when voices that usually appear in the last paragraph are given central place. We spoke with Battle for Brooklyn filmmakers Suki Hawley and Michael Galinsky.
Visible, when people can accept with near certainty things that aren't at all certain or aren't even true. Frivolous lawsuits are clogging up the courts. Juries are awarding outrageously generous sums of money to people looking to cash in at the courthouse. A new documentary tells a very different story. The real political fight over the past few decades has been not about runaway juries and frivolous lawsuits, but about business interests spending millions to make sure you don't have your day in court. That is the subject of a new documentary film called Hot Coffee, which will be airing on HBO this month. The film is produced and directed by Susan Saladoff. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Susan Saladoff.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, the case that gives the film its name is a good place to start. Everyone knows the story of the old woman who sued McDonald's for millions of dollars because her coffee was hot. You have this, in the film, this reel of news clips, mentions on sitcoms, and interviews with people on the street, and they do seem to know what this case is about. They're pretty confident that they've got the story right, and it turns out that they've got almost everything about it wrong.
Sure. So, you know, almost everybody, as you said, knows it or they think they know about the McDonald's case. It's been cited as the most infamous case in the world. People all over the world literally have heard of this case, but almost everybody has it wrong because the media got it wrong. I mean, the night that the verdict came out, Jane Pauley was substituting for Tom Brokaw as the anchor on the NBC Nightly News, and she reported that the woman was driving the car when she spilled the coffee. I mean, the woman was in a parked car. She was 79 years old. The car, you know, she was the passenger in the car, and she was severely burned. I mean, burned so badly that they had to literally take skin from her thighs and sew it into her private parts. And all she wanted was the difference between what Medicaid paid for her medical bills and what her medical bills were. And McDonald's never offered her more than $800 up through the time of trial. And they had paid out over 700 times to other people who had been burned by coffee because they knew that their coffee would burn people within 3 to 7 seconds of contact.
It's striking, you know, this case when you lay it out, and it shocks people when you're doing these on the street interviews, when you show them the pictures of her burns. It shocks them because they've never heard of any of this part of the story. But if you accept some of these bogus ideas about the judicial system, then you can accept these so-called fixes. One of the four cases that you profile in the film talks about caps on damages. And if you believe that runaway jury awards are the problem, then it would seem like a simple solution, one that sort of has an intuitive appeal. Well, if people are getting too much money from juries, then we should just put a cap on it. This is a long-standing fight from people like the Chamber of Commerce, right?
Absolutely. And what's so unfair about that is that the people whose cases are being capped are never the frivolous lawsuits because, truthfully, I don't actually think that there are as many frivolous lawsuits as people want to believe. But the ones that are being capped are the ones that are people have been most injured because the juries have given such a large award. So by definition, after two sides argue a case and a jury gives an award, it can't be frivolous. And yet the other thing that happens is that in many of our states, there are these caps on damages. And the propaganda or the information that's given to the public is, well, somehow, you know, doctors' insurance rates are going up too much because of this. But and if we cap damages, you know, your insurance rates will, the doctor's insurance rates will be down, your health care costs will be down. But the truth is that in those states where tort reform or where these caps have been enacted, doctors' insurance rates don't go down and our health care bills don't go down because insurance companies, frankly, don't have to pass along the savings to anybody. They just make more profits.
It's striking. You know, we interviewed John Stossela, who comes up in your documentary near the beginning when he did this Trouble with Lawyers special back in the 90s. And the premise of it is that there are these runaway juries and outrageous lawyers looking to sue anyone to make a buck. But he admitted on our show that, you know, you don't really have anything to prove that that's the case, that there's no sense, you know, you can't point to a study that shows that this is a real problem. But it does have this kind of intuitive appeal to people because of the years of propaganda. You were a lawyer for 25 years practicing. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to make the film.
You know, I knew that there was this large public relations campaign to convince the public that our system was out of control. And I knew that the information that was being put out was distorted, that it wasn't true. And I wanted to tell the truth. I knew that our system was working, and most people think it's not working. And what happens is that, you know, if you repeat things over and over again, people start to believe it. In fact, we have a neurolinguistics professor in the film, George Lakoff from Berkeley, and he says, you know, if you repeat things over and over again, the brain changes, and people start to believe things. It's almost like on the Sunday news shows, you know how all of the people who are talking, they're always using the same words? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they get the same paper in the morning that says, okay, repeat these words over and over again. And sort of like the death tax instead of the estate tax. You know, these are words that are market tested to inflate, infuriate people, to present, you know, a sense of fear in them. And, you know, frivolous lawsuit, jackpot justice, a lawsuit lottery, these were all market tested terms to convince the public that our system is broken. And if people believe that the court system is broken, then they're willing to change it. They're willing to reform it, which, you know, these days people think reform is a good thing. But all reform means is it takes our rights as citizens away and puts more money in the pockets of corporations. Because if we can't hold wrongdoers accountable in our court system, they make more money.
Language is so important. You know, you're talking about all of these terms, and one that you cover in the film is tort reform, where you interview people, and they're not really sure what tort means, but it has kind of a weird negative connotation. Everyone knows what reform means. Reform is something that's good, so whatever tort reform is, it must be a good thing.
Right, and most people don't know that tort reform is really different ways that our rights, our constitutional rights, are being taken away from us. And in our film, Hot Coffee, we demonstrate through four different storylines, four different ways that we as Americans are giving up our rights to access the courts. And most people don't even know that we're doing it.
You know, one of the cases was about sort of the flip side. We have these moneyed interests who are trying to promote certain ideas and to win in the court of public opinion through repetition and propaganda. And if you can't win in the court of public opinion, you can go about changing the judges who are sitting in court. Tell us about that case and one particular state Supreme Court justice.
So in most of our states now, we elect our judges, and our judges even to the Supreme Courts of our states, which of course is our highest courts. And in Mississippi, there was a judge named Oliver Diaz, who is actually, his story is fictionalized in John Grisham's book, The Appeal. And we documented the true story of this judge who was on the Mississippi State Supreme Court, whom the U.S. Chamber of Commerce thought was too consumer-oriented. He wasn't pro-business enough. Now, most people don't even know what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is. I mean, they think that it's a government agency. When the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the largest lobbying organization for corporations in the world, and they targeted in Mississippi this judge for defeat. And they basically funded with over $1 million the campaign of another person who they thought was more pro-business. And despite the fact that they put all this money in with, you know, campaigns with television ads and so on attacking, Justice Diaz actually wound up winning the election. But despite the fact that he won, he was then there were these false criminal charges that were brought against him, and he then had to be off the bench for 3 years fighting these false criminal charges. He was eventually acquitted, but his reputation by that point was so tainted that he was unable to win his next election.
Exactly. Well, if you're going to war with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, either actively or because they declared war on you, you can expect some pushback. I suspect the Chamber of Commerce is not looking too kindly upon hot coffee right now.
Well, you know, I'm suspecting that, but I haven't seen anything directly yet. You know, we're leading up to our premiere on HBO on June 27th. One thing that I do know is I was in Little Rock. I'm on the film festival circuit right now. I'm actually in L.A. right this minute. But a week ago, I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was screening at the Bill Clinton School for Public Service. And this man comes up to me, and he said, "I'm a reporter for this newspaper called The Legal News Line, and I'm here to cover the story." And I said, "Really, where are you from?" And he said, "West Virginia." He says, "But I want you to know that our newspaper is owned by the Institute for Legal Reform." Now, the Institute for Legal Reform is one of the entities of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And I said, "Really?" I said, "Wow, I've been expecting you to be here or someone from the U.S. Chamber at almost every screening. I usually start my Q&A and say, will the member of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce please raise their hand?" And he said, "I'm going to cover this story." And I said, "Okay, well, is there any way you could be objective and really cover it, you know?" And he said, "Well, I'm a reporter." And I said, "Yeah, but your paycheck is being paid by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce." And so what's so ironic about this is that this guy, I haven't seen his review yet, but he's going to write an article, and it's going to go in newspapers around the country. And people who are reading the newspaper will not know that that article was written by a reporter whose paycheck is coming from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is so ironic because that's exactly what my movie's about.
Well, we've been speaking with Susan Saladoff. She is producer and director of the film Hot Coffee. It premieres on HBO on June 27th. You can find out more about the film at hotcoffeethemovie.com. Susan Saladoff, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
At the end of the new film, Battle for Brooklyn, about the people who fought back against a private developer's use of state power to take over a New York neighborhood, a man says, if the media had done their job, this would have been a fair fight. While not its direct subject, media are definitely actors in this story, which is still evolving, and in the film that explores it. That's, as you might anticipate, as much for what they did not report as for what and how they did. Joining us now in studio are the filmmakers behind Battle for Brooklyn, Michael Galinsky and Suki Hawley. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Well, the background materials on the film say that you became interested in this story not just because you live near the site where this Atlantic Yards project was set to happen, but also because of an accounting of it that you saw in the New York Times?
Exactly. A lot of the work that we do starts with media. We read something and we say, you know what, I'm not getting the whole picture there. And that was exactly the case here. It really read like a press release. Everything was all about this wonderful thing that was coming to Brooklyn. We live right there and we thought, that doesn't make any sense. So I started asking my neighbors and they all said, oh, you know, I read about it too. It's going to happen. There's nothing you can do. The governor, the mayor, everyone's for it. Then I saw a sign that said, stop the project. So I called the number on the sign. It was this woman, Patty Hagen, who had started the fight against the project, and she started talking my ear off. I said, I'll see you in 5 minutes. I got in my car, I went over, and I started filming immediately. And she told me the truth. She told me what was really going on and how that was this huge land grab that nobody in the community that was going to be displaced had been consulted at all, and it was being sold as this community building project. They were going to build a neighborhood from scratch. I think that was the line that got me in the paper. It said, a neighborhood from scratch? There's a neighborhood there. What are you talking about? And that's kind of how we rolled into it.
Well, we're going to fill in a little bit on what this project is, because it's not an unheard-of scenario. It will be familiar to listeners around the country, at least parts of it. In fact, it's been well-documented in a great book called Field of Schemes, the idea that a private developer or owner will demand public subsidy to build what is, in essence, a private enterprise, a sports arena, or often it's a new sports arena. Promises are made, lots of jobs, lots of economic growth. Sports boosterism and local pride are evoked. In this case, with the developer Bruce Ratner and the Atlantic Yards project in Brooklyn, the anchor of it was going to be an arena for the New Jersey Nets basketball
team. Anchor or a Trojan horse.
I was just going to say, this case, though, even though that might be familiar to people, this case did seem to have some extra levels of outrage thrown in. And some things that happened that seemed to be illegal or extra legal, you might say. What were, like, the eminent domain element, for example, which is a big part of the film? What's that about?
Eminent domain, most people consider it the right of the government to take private property for public use. And the public use, people generally consider a hospital, you know, a civic purpose, a museum, a road, although the definition of eminent domain has now been expanded to be some kind of other private development that will bring in more economic growth. And so in this case, that was what was happening here at the Atlantic Yards project.
Now, as to qualify for eminent domain, though, and this is key, the neighborhood or whatever is there existing has to be declared blighted.
Right. It's different laws from state to state. But yes, in this case, that was the justification, that this neighborhood that was really on the up and up, that converted condos were opening all the time for, you know, $500, $600 a square foot, this was blighted. And it was used as a justification to take the whole neighborhood because that's what they wanted. The developer actually owned a huge piece of property across the street, but he didn't want to build there because he had plans to build high-rises there. So he had to take this other land in order to do it. And then they talked about 17 skyscrapers as well and a lot of public space. But that public space was going to be inside the ring of skyscrapers that would not really be a public space. It would be privately owned, publicly accessible space. All these insane things were going on, but nobody, this is where you get to the meat part, nobody was really getting to that. They just kind of would print what the developer said, and then they would sometimes get a comment from the naysayers. And it's funny you bring up Field of Schemes, because right when I met Patty, she held up that book, and it's a line I kind of wish we'd kept in. She said, you know, we talked to Neil DeMoss, and he said, or Jim Boughton, who wrote another book about baseball stadium, said, they're going to say it's a handful of naysayers, which is actually exactly what they said in response to the film. There were a handful of malcontents who said this was a bad thing, but the majority of Brooklynites were for this, which just wasn't true. And, you know, even in response to the film, they already trotted out Bruce Ratner with a Daily News article by a person who really didn't know the story. And, you know, he talked about eating vindication cake, like, because he's being vindicated because they're building an arena. Really? You know, and that's what they print it. It becomes the overwhelming narrative, you know.
That you then are countering. Well, one is struck again and again in the film, and not just as a media critic, but with the contrast between the story that the corporate press most often, there were exceptions, but most often told and continue to tell, and the stories that you tell. And it's not, I don't think, about the strictures of daily journalism versus those of filmmaking, the luxury of time, et cetera. It's really more fundamental choices about who you talk to and how much attention you give them. You know, the same people, the corporate reps, the big politicians, the smaller politicians, some community groups, some individuals, the same range of characters are in this film as occurred in the press coverage, but in such different quantities and with such a different quality of treatment.
Right, and it's interesting because there is a scene where Patty says, oh, I'm supposed to walk around with a Newsweek reporter after he walks around with the Ratner people. And so you actually see, we get a zoom in close up of someone walking around with Bruce Bender, the VP at Forest City Ratner, the developer, and we have just met him in the film, so we know who he is. And we understand that that reporter is most likely getting the same story that we got. And, you know, ad nauseum, he goes on, and he does talk a lot, and that's his job. But what ended up getting reported by them was very different than what made it into the film.
Well, let's be clear that lots of voices are heard in this film. We were talking before about the reviews and claiming it's one-sided, which is fascinating because you really do hear a lot from the proponents of this project in the film.
But we are with the characters or fighting it. And in fact, if it didn't feel like you're with them, then we would have failed because we're making a film about people. And if you don't feel in some ways that you're with them, then you haven't gone on this journey with us. And so while it is a documentary, we really look at it as a movie. And you wouldn't say in Aaron Brockovich, for instance, you know, wasn't that movie about the lawyers who were fighting for the company that was poisoning the water? It's an unfair movie. Because that's what we made, a movie.
We decided to make a film that was character-driven and, you know, something to look at human beings under pressure and not something that was necessarily so issue-driven, although the issues do come out and in stark relief, I think, because of the way we've done it.
And really what we wanted to do was use the movie as an opportunity to have conversations like this, and not only for us but for other people to have these conversations, because there were people like Norman Oder is the person you mentioned at the end of the film. He spent years writing the Atlantic Yards Report blog, and he really did incredible reporting, and he did break some stories that the mainstream media covered. But for instance, right now, they're raising $500 million from foreign investors, and they're getting green cards for these things. Nobody's reporting on it except Norman, and it's insane. The idea is that for $500 million, they're going to create 7,000 jobs or something like that. And nobody's reporting on it. They're not creating any jobs. It's just madness.
And it's not as though real estate and use of public funds are not big issues for the media here. It's a question of how they're covered. Well, part of what the opponents of this project had to counter were certain storylines from the press. First, the kind of, you know, New York Post bonanza sort of, you know, this is going to be great for everyone in the sports boosterism machine. But then there was this very specific idea that the people who were being displaced by this project were all being bought out, and now we're millionaires. And
right.
That was a storyline that, you know, we did hear again and again. What right do they have to complain?
Right.
And if you hadn't told it as a personal story, I think you'd miss, you know, Daniel Goldstein saying, every time reporters saw him, all they'd ask is, what's your price?
Yeah.
What are you holding out for? What's your price? And he was saying, ask me about the bigger questions. But that was the media's angle.
Yeah, and if we hadn't shown it like that, we wouldn't have shown the risks that these people took, that Daniel took. He sacrificed so much, and he gained a lot, too, you know. And so
he
it was
a family.
Yeah, he gained a wife who was an activist as well. He, you know, they had a daughter together. And, you know, they did create this life around their activism. But and he didn't start out an activist. He sacrificed a lot, but and then in the end maybe gained, you know, something, but it wasn't what he was looking for, and it wasn't at all what the fight was about.
But back to what you said, this idea, there was that Daily News cover, it said bonanza, instant millionaires. But these people had bought their apartment for, say, $600,000. They were paid $1 million, but in the time that they had that took place, that was the year of the 25% run-up in Brooklyn real estate. So in fact, they really hadn't made out like bandits in any way whatsoever, and their whole lives were disrupted. So
and not everyone got that big check.
And the people who were renters basically got nothing. In fact, one person reviewed the film recently, and she was a person who was kicked out of a building on Vanderbilt. She moved to London. She was just displaced. It's like, oh, I got to move. You know, there's an amazing book by a woman named Mindy Foley Love called Root Shock, and it's about the emotional effects of pulling up a community by its roots. All of the social capital is destroyed, and it takes forever for it to re-root itself, especially when you're talking about people who don't have a great deal of capital, right? So those people who have built up social networks that create neighborhoods, when they're displaced, they don't have the capital to recreate in a positive way as easily.
And in terms of everybody understanding what happened, when those people disappear, well, then there's no one there to tell the story. And I think one of the key things that came through, you see, really see the value of information, of communication. Positively in these community meetings where you see people learning from face-to-face conversation whole realities that are not on TV. But then there's also the fact that the developers and the state keep insisting on gag orders from various players in the story, which I find so key. It really speaks to how powerful it is to be able to say something.
To control the narrative. And in fact, that's one of the things that we're facing is like we said, some of the reviews are like, oh, it's one-sided, it's following these people. But you have to remember that the developer spent literally well over $1 million per year on publicity, right, on just a publicist. When you spend that kind of money and you have that kind of money, you control the narrative. And that narrative is infectious. So, for instance, this is a really interesting thing. Michael O'Keefe in the Daily News wrote a really amazing piece about the film. It got picked up by Yahoo. So it was on the Yahoo main page, which meant there were hundreds of comments on it. And literally every comment was, that guy Dan moved in after the thing was announced because he just wanted to try and stick them for money. And literally, they created that narrative. And so there's a point where they're like, the people who want jobs are yelling, Goldstein's got to go, Goldstein's got to go. And I really felt a sense of danger from that. And it's about this kind of idea that here's this guy, they've turned him into the other. They've turned him into kill the pig, kill the pig, kill the pig. And it scared me a little bit. I was a little worried for him. He's the only person in this building. You know, some people egged on by this might feel like they had to take it in their own hands. And that was really, it's crazy.
And you tell people that they don't have supporters. You know, for those of us who are not Daniel Goldstein but are just following the story, you think, well, he's alone. He's the only one who's on that side.
Right.
That's not even true.
No,
you know,
it's not true
you really undermine democracy by telling people there's nothing you can do. It's already done.
Right. It's the opposite. The only reason he stayed in that apartment was because he was the guy with his finger in the dike. He had standing to fight it, and he was fighting. He was holding up 4,000 of his neighbors who had contributed small amounts to Develop, Don't Destroy, and he felt a responsibility to them. I'll tell you right now, he would have been happy to leave a long time before that. There were, stuff that didn't make it in the movie where he's just like, God, I can't do this anymore. But he knew he had to, you know.
Well, let me ask you, the press sheet says it's a story of one man under pressure, and it is that. But it's also, I think, in many important ways not about one man. What do you hope people will take away from this film?
I really hope that people will feel informed and inspired by the film. And even New Yorkers who have lived through this, I think, don't have the full picture at all, as we've been discussing about how the press handled it. And so in that way, they'll feel informed. They'll say, oh, my God, I had no idea that that's what
happened. And I'm going to look at other stories differently from now on. That's the goal. Like, we want to make films that raise questions much more than answer them. There's no facts in the movie. We tried to avoid numbers. We tried to avoid all of the details, A, because they were so heinous it was almost impossible to handle, but B, because that's not what it was. And, you know, there's that line in the press release, it's about a man under pressure. And the reason that this is in there is because we're trying to control the narrative about the film in a way. Because so many people go into a documentary thinking, okay, I'm going to see a documentary, there's going to be this person on this side of the screen saying this, and this person on the other side saying that. And they have this expectation. And so we want to control the expectation that really this is a movie, just And those expectations are infectious as well. Like, if you think you're going to drink milk and you drink orange juice, it's not very comfortable.
So you're following a story. You're following a story about human beings.
Right.
And like all human beings, they're involved in social and political action.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We've been speaking with Suki Hawley and Michael Galinsky. Their new film, Battle for Brooklyn, opens this weekend in Brooklyn and Manhattan and around the country after that. There's information online at battleforbrooklyn.com. Thank you both for joining us on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.